My name is Bobby Baker. I am a woman. I am an artist. I was born in Sidcup, Kent, in 1950.
Can you tell us something about your early childhood, your background, early memories?
I think what strikes me most, because you know, you think about your early life as you get older, especially as you're children are getting older, or you know, I reflect a lot on things. And so what I realized about my parents is that they were aspirational. They were that generation. They had a really tough time in the war, and they came out of it, and life was really hard. My dad was in the Navy in a fairly lowly position, and he worked in the city, and he got very, very sick. But then he recovered, and then, you know, they worked and they worked and they worked, and they'd got this terrible house that inherited from my grandparents that was, you know, a bleak, big house that was falling apart. And so they just worked very hard. So they aspired for a lot for us, so sort of scholarships and stuff. I've got an elder sister, 8 years older, and a brother who's 2 years older. So we grew up in the suburbs, and apart from the sort of emotional undercurrent of the family life, which stemmed from my poor old mum, it was pretty happy in many ways, and knocked about a bit. And because I was the youngest, and decidedly, as I was told, the mistake, which caused them to move into the terrible barren house, that there wasn't a great expectation of me. My sister was to be a scholar or a sports person, and my brother was to be a wealthy man. Mm. And work in the city, and the biggest thing my parents aspired to was to join the golf club in Chislehurst and get out this crumbling place full of my grandfather's fossils, actually, that they'd left behind. He was a really unusual engineer, and so what I was supposed, I was told by my mum to be, that I was going to be a nice nurse, and I remember I was given this belt by some woman she knew, who was this really skinny lady who came around in her nurse's outfit and gave me this belt with a really good buckle on. I was like 9, and I couldn't get it around my waist because I was always very tall for my age. And I remember thinking, oh, I can't be a nurse. But by then I'd already decided, because I remember trailing along behind my mum. We went past Sidcup Art School, and my brother said, that's when naked ladies take their clothes off in there. And about the same time, my aunt and my mum were giggling, and they were looking at a Punch cartoon, and we looked at it, and it was a man with a floppy hat, and in a little booth at the corner there was a naked lady, and he was saying something really sexy, like, you know, I'm waiting for you, Miss So-and-so. And we thought it was really, you know, and I thought, I want to be an artist model. If that's what, I don't know why, I was 7. And then my great aunt, her husband was killed in the First World War, and she had gone to the Slade. She'd managed to go to the Slade, which was the sort of family dream of my grandmother and everything, never got there. And she became a really well-known art teacher at Bromley High School. Mm. And she actually taught the princesses, Princess Elizabeth and Margaret art. And she came and to had tea, and she gave me an art lesson when I was 9. She was extraordinary. I remember doing this very careful piece of work, and that's when I decided I'd be an artist, not an artist model. And I kind of carried on. There was a brilliant art teacher at school called Miss Burgess, but I did really quite fancy being leading part in school plays. I was very tall for my age, and I never got any parts. And when I did get a part, I thought, oh, it's a bit crummy working with all these people and everybody arguing. So, and I was so devoted to Mrs. Burgess, who was an extraordinary teacher, inspirational teacher, and very rigorous about technique. So from then on, I think I wanted to be an artist, and that's what I aspired to.
But there was a performative thing in the background.
Yeah, when I look back on it, I liked performing, and I suppose the artist model might be that. Mm. Showing off, exhibitionist. But yeah, it was the drawing and the passion of art and whatever. And my parents, you know, there wasn't a lot of pressure. They thought I was thick. And there wasn't this kind of pressure that my sister had, for instance, or my brother, to do well academically. I did okay, but it was more that I could do what I wanted.
And your first impressions of art school?
My dad had drowned very tragically on a family holiday in between me going to the local grammar school to do A-levels. And it affected, clearly, and I look back on it, it affected things. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy, which I definitely got over at an early age, but what was difficult was what it did to the family. And my mum really fell apart. And I just coasted through the sixth form, trying to be good, actually, with my technique. And then in the second year, because I hated it, we were told we were creme de la creme de la creme. just lessons in grammar school for girls, and because we were in the sixth form. Oh yeah, we went to university with the creme de la creme de la creme. We were the creme de la creme. I just hated it. I hated to discover I'd been a snob. And then I kind of realised that I just didn't want to be part of all of that. The art was awful. I went to Sig Cup Art School evening classes. My mum got me into that. Saved me, actually. A brilliant couple of teachers. And I got into St Martin's, which nobody had ever got into art school, let alone St Martin's. I wanted to get away from Bromley, which is where my mum wanted me to do stained glass, because it had a job attached. So I went to St Martin's, and it was just extraordinary. But, you know, when you look back on that, you're sort of rather shocked. All I thought about was what I wore every day, actually. I didn't realise it was an achievement to get in. I had this Dorothy Perkins skirt, mini skirt, which was black corduroy, and a fetching jumper from Dorothy Perkins with a kind of black vine thing and tights and some boots. And I didn't know what to wear every day. So I wore the same thing every day for a term. And really, I was so concerned with that because I hadn't had a uniform. And the fact that my mum always cooked me this big cooked breakfast because she thought I needed it. So I finally went to the doctor at the end of the first term because I had these stomach aches, and he told me I had indigestion. So I kind of loved it. I loved it. I mean, it was the glory days of pre-dip, you know. There were a lot of tutors, some amazing people, wonderful actually. And we were taught and we were taught and we were taught. There were no spare moment of your day. There were only 80 of us, and the space is probably now 500 in. But it was a very structured course. And I actually, you know, when I look back on it, I kind of unlearned. I got into the painting course. I was pretty shell-shocked when I realised the effect of my dad's death. I think I was probably pretty shell-shocked still, and our family was troubled with my mum, but it was bliss to get to London. But I got into the painting course there because of my drawings from Sig Cup, I think. They were technically very good. And then I think the rest of my time there doing painting was pretty lost, pissing about really, but with a good social life. And I was quite troubled at times, but also blissfully happy. I remember every time you had to sign in, and every day I signed in, I thought, I want to do this for the rest of my life. I love it here. I was a community, an exploration, and an escape. And I tried all sorts of things. I think the second year was the happiest. Very lost the first year with what to do. I objected the fact you were meant to be an artist instantly. And I've always spoken my mind. I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to be an artist. I'm 17. I was 18 by then. I was just became 18 the first term. You know, it's like, so I thought that was ridiculous, but I didn't know what to do. And then in the second year, I moved into a great studio with a bunch of people, and I just did masses of colour studies, actually. Colour studies, I don't know, I just kept doing things because I didn't know what else to do. And my mum said if I didn't produce something, I would have to go to secretarial college.
That's a good reason.
and I made really good friends. And we all kind of worked away. Kind of, you know, you either copied being an artist or you just worked away. I don't think by then I had... My biggest fear when I was at art school was that somebody would come along, literally. So I walked along the corridors, I used to think this. Somebody would come along, because I loved the tutors, I loved the world. And they, one of them would tap me on the shoulder and they'd say, I'm sorry, you can't be an artist. You're a woman, you're a girl. And I really thought that a lot. And I was a middle class girl. And all my friends came from the north. It was the era of, you know, sort of not, the guy who won the Pratt Bequest, which was the prize, was and he was called Northern Star in the stakes. I was called English Rose. Mm. And I was, you know, I had great friends, but I knew there was a tradition of middle class girls going to art school, but I wanted to be an artist. I really seriously wanted to be an artist. I didn't know what to do. Which maybe is the same, is it was the artist was superior, and I didn't agree with that. I just felt we're the same as everybody else, but I wanted to be one. And yet I was a girl, and I remember I was really friendly with a couple of tutors, and one of them said, it's funny, occasionally people talk about students in the staff room, and if your name comes up, they say, oh, Bobby Baker, she's such a nice girl. She's such a nice girl. And he said, they don't know what you get up to. Because I was pretty out of control a lot of the time, you know. It was mostly drink. I knew if I took drugs, like some of my friends did. They, you know, three of them were dead by the time they were 30. And so I didn't do that, but I was kind of lurching about a bit.
Who were you inspired by? What things were making an effect on you?
I didn't know. Suzanne. Mm. I used to go and see Les Grands Beigneurs regularly on the way from the Charing Cross station. I'd go and see that in the National Gallery and draw it. But he was a man. Yeah, I like painters. And then I discovered Oldenburg. And somebody in the student union sold a limited edition copy of a notebook of Oldenburg's sketches. And I had it in my pocket for about 5 years. I've still got it, this little pocketbook it was of his sketches. I remember I used to look at them and I'd feel, you know when you're electrified by excitement. And I read a great book which had John Cage in it, Tanguelli, I can never pronounce his name. It's a phobia. And that was very exciting. But it was the Oldenburg and Liechtenstein. And there was an amazing exhibition in the Tate. And I went again and again and I saw this one Liechtenstein painting of this giant brushstroke that filled the whole wall. And I just sit there, I mean, for hours, just overwhelmed by that. The other thing was Oldenburg and whoever it was. I didn't really go for Rauschenberg and so much, but the whole movement excited me enormously. I think it was the their store. They did that store. And I thought that was just fantastic that they'd made these objects and sold them in a shop. Then when I look back on it, I was influenced by, because it was the British School of Sculpture was very pivotal in the sculpture department. I had friends who were there and actually left because it was rather rigorous. Other ones who thrived. And there used to be Anthony Caro with the Trail of Disciples. And Bruce Lacey had been there, as had Gilbert and George, who'd left, I suppose, a couple of years before. They were doing some really thrilling work. So the first time I ever saw any performance, I'd sort of wandered in, you know, and there was the big hall at the basement, and I walked in there, and Gilbert and George were on the stage, or they were on a table. Maybe they weren't on the stage, they were on a table doing Underneath the Arches. They weren't gold, it was before they did it in gold. But I think I was probably a bit drunk, but I remember thinking that was quite cool. And then the bit that was magic, though, was in the seminar room in the library. What do they call it? Critical studies. It wasn't, or liberal studies. It wasn't sort of education. There were amazing seminars, amazing people teaching. There was this guy, Michael Moon, who once he was giving a seminar and he smoked Gulwa with a tip. And he was so intent on what he was talking to us about that he smoked through the tip. He smoked it the one way around. I loved him. But, you know, it was that kind of passion about ideas. So I went to this seminar, and it was Bruce Lacey performing British School of Sculpture's photographs. And the panel were Gilbert and George. So they sat at one side, and Bruce Lacey was over the other side. And it was packed full of, you know, tutors. I remember all these people standing at the back and this tension, because my ex-boyfriend had been in the School of Sculpture, so I knew a lot about it. And so they, you know, one of them would say, right, you know, Mr. Lacey, what do you think of this? And they'd hold up a drawing with one of those titles, and he'd perform it. He'd sort of go, meow, boom, you know, like that. And there was a photograph, and then we'd all cheer and laugh. And so they did that, and that must have been, you know, at the time I was just knocked sideways with delight, but that must have had an effect on me. Yeah. But altogether, I was very disillusioned with the whole thing. I'm just disillusioned with the elitism. I was always cracking on about that. And I just got to doing a lot of paintings just to get through the degree. So I painted my teddy bears and I painted my shoes. And it was a troubled time my last year. And I refused to go to teacher's training, which we were supposed to do to get a job. And I was on the academic panel, and I used to berate them for their elitism. I loved doing our dissertation. I did that. It was meant to be about making chocolate mousse. But it was a lot of ideas, but it was quite a diffuse piece of work, but I loved that process. And then I left, and I felt liberated, actually. I thought, well, I've had enough of that. I didn't like the fine art world, I didn't like the exhibitions. I used to go and, you know, hang around and get drunk, but I didn't want to make work just went on a wall that somebody bought. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I didn't want to be an artist like that. So I just left, thinking, well, I'll do something else, actually.
And when did the first performance here?
Well, it was a very kind of tempestuous time when I left, because I ended up without anywhere to live, losing my family, home and everything. It was, oh gosh, it was awful. And I ended up living in a short life property in Annerley in South London with a guy. And it was an old butcher's shop, and all boarded up. He was very paranoid, so we had to pretend we weren't there, but we had these four floors and kind of fungus in the basement and floods, and then, but masses of space. So we made it a home. It had a very genteel drawing room on the top floor. And it was very dramatic, actually. There was all sorts of dramatic things happen. But I took up a small business some friends had started up in their garage, which was dyeing baseball boots to sell through Private Eye, because you can get coloured baseball boots. So we hand dyed them, all this process, lovely smell the dye had. So advertised in Private Eye, and that was my job. I used to go and sell them. I sold three pairs to Reginald Bosanquet, who was a TV presenter. I remember thinking, is he wearing a bar? I don't know, it was a funny old time, but I had a studio, a room, but I didn't know what to do. I'm thinking, so I just thought, well, I can't do anything. And then one night it was really, you know, the dyeing of the boots took hours, and I was in the kitchen on my own, and I've always loved cooking chocolate mousse, cooking cake decorating. I was just loved it. And so I had a bit of Madeira cake, and I decided for some reason that is lost to me to make a baseball boot out of Madeira cake. and I had some icing, and I made this cake very badly, and I put it on my grandmother's cake plate, and then, you know, had this kind of what you would call an epiphany, but I rolled on the floor with delight at this pathetically badly made object on my dresser, and I just all I could think about was walking into St Martin's and saying, here is a work of art of equal significance to this caro here. It was just bliss. And I think that was just, that was it. It was the turning point. I just got electrified at the thought of making art out of food. I did masses, you know, I'd make these women out meringues. I learned all the techniques. I bought all the equipment. I ruined my teeth. And I had tea parties. And I remember a whole bunch of friends from, you know, our friends coming. And there was this incredible spread of exquisitely made. That was a little lady sitting in miniature armchair. And life's, you know, just little figure made out of cake. And when you cut into her, she was all different colours. And it was just, people couldn't cope with it. You know, it didn't work as a party. Mm-hmm. It was just too much. And then I made a life-size baby on a meat platter. And then somebody who I'd been to art school with asked me to go and do a performance during that year to celebrate Princess Anne's wedding. That's right, it did her second wedding anniversary a while later. When was the wedding? I can't remember if I was still at college or I just left. And he wanted me to be Princess Anne. I'm the same age as her. And there was three or four of us just outside St Martin's on Charing Cross Road with all this stuff all over the pavement. What I was doing, how I got there, the velvet coat on, and I thought, this is fantastic. I didn't have the food, and I met these two people called Keith and Marie, and there were other people, you know, like knocking about, and I thought, oh, I like this. But then I made the cake. I was making the cakes, and then I met them, and I said, well, I make these cakes, and they said, well, come and just put your cakes in our performances. And they were extremely nice to me. And so I did my first proper performance at Oval House with a life-size baby. And I kind of chopped it up in the middle and everybody fell off the chairs. And I didn't know what I was doing. Did not care. Just knew it was right. I just did masses of work. Mostly completely chaotic. One year I moved 10 times. And so my equipment to make the meringues, I used to get a lot of opportunities to make the meringue ladies who used to dress up like them. And I remember ending up staying in somebody's house in Putney, and I was doing a performance the next day at Oval House, and I'd lost everything, but they had 12 eggs, and I got some icing sugar, and then have an electric whisk, which I'd got left somewhere else. So I handmade 60 meringues, stayed up all night, and you know, my hours were very regular. I was very, very pleased with them, and I put them all on their sitting room floor, these beautiful little meringues, thinking, oh, I'm going to sleep now, and they just got up and came in. I went, look what I made, and they went, ah! And their dog came in and ate two-thirds of them. He just sort of chucked them in, and then he was sent outside and he threw them all, you know, sick on the grass. So I just turned up at Oval House, a bit dazed, with 20 meringues. I think I remember arriving at places just dressed up like a meringue with these meringues and going, and but I think that was the nature of my chaotic life. And then I met Andrew and I moved into a artist housing association, you know, ACME, at a prefab in Stepney. And that's when I decided, I suppose, actually, to make my answer to, you know, Oldenburg, which was this life-size family. I'd made one woman, that's right. I wasn't invited to be in the New Contemporaries. I was never part of regular things. I didn't try to be, you know, I did an art teacher certificate at Goldsmiths. And that was a fact. fantastic because they never expected me. I think they gave up on me in teaching practice quite early. And it was liberal. There was amazing courses. Barbara Rice, who's, I think, an extraordinary art historian, she came and gave a series of talks, which... and I did my teaching practice in the end in adult education. And I did write that bit. I loved the adult bit. I couldn't do the schools. And I did a lot of work then, and I did a really... I mean, a lot of my work was terrible. You know, it just went on for hours and was very boring. I discovered that I could make people laugh. And I thought, actually, the work is so boring. Perhaps that's an advantage. Because people seem to like laughing. Because initially, when I talked about these cakes, when I went on the course, everybody rolled about laughing. And I went and wept in the toilet. Was so embarrassed. Because, you know, I really thought they were amazing. But then people were sewing these amazing drawings and things, and I wanted to be like them. Mm. And it was a really powerful moment because I thought, well, I am this person and I am me and I've just got to follow what I do and I can't be that. I can't be somebody else. I tried to be somebody else. And I thought, well, even if people don't like what I do and take it seriously, I do. And so I'll just do it. Mm. And that's a pretty powerful thing to think at that age, sort of 23, when I look back on it. Because I was so passionate about it, as one is, you know, it's just... and so the performance was pretty dull, and I made a life-size person I did for that. It was called the Life Room, and a lot of paintings. It was my final piece. It was a very boring performance, but it was visually stunning. So when I got the prefab, that's when I made... I made the Edible Family. Mm. I applied to the Arts Council and I got sort of £363.20 or something, you know. I kind of costed it very precisely. And I decorated that prefab. Every surface had newsprint appropriate to the person, family member in the room, and then icing all over it. So it was very beautiful. And then a figure, you know, so it was like a father, he had his radio. No, he had a TV. The mother was in the kitchen, she was a survivor. She had teapot, fresh food every day in her dressmaker thing. She wheeled about. And she had a radio. Baby in the corner, in my original cot, all covered with baby magazine, was life-size coconut cake. The teenage daughter in the parents' bedroom was a sort of suspended wire basket. It was all pink and grey and silver and pale blue. It was and pale green. It was stunning. It started.
So was this an installation or were you performing inside?
Both.
It? Both. Yeah.
It was open for a week.
Yeah.
And I was there 8 hours a day, showing people around. I did a lot of local publicity and invites. Mm. And there was this family that they ate.
Mm.
So the daughter was meringues. The son, who was about 12, was in the bath, sort of, he was like a strange tree in chocolate cake, water, made out of Garibaldi biscuits. And I didn't know why I chose that. I didn't know why I did anything.
Mm.
And my terror was that somebody like the, you know, you can't be an artist bit. I thought people would look at it because it was such a big piece of work, my first proper big piece of work. I thought people would say, why did you do that? Why did you make it out of Garibaldi biscuits? Why did you make a head-to-head out of teapot? I don't know. And they didn't at art school talk about things like intuition and critical theory in the same way. But I knew that would be a concern, and I didn't know. And it was such a pressure practically to get it done that I just thought, well, I just have to do it. I've no idea why I'm doing that. But I knew exactly what I wanted to do in each situation.
Well, the thing is also a little bit scary. I remember seeing photographs of the boy in the bath in particular.
No, when it opened, it was exquisite. It was, it was, people would go and go, oh, it was so beautiful, because it was sugar, but it became horrific. Yeah, as it was eaten. By the end, it was sort of Chainsaw Massacre time. I mean, really, but it also smelt, because the butter icing went rancid. And the process of it being eaten was extraordinary, because at times, you know, get a crowd of people, and it would be very convivial, because there was tea and fresh food, and it's like it wasn't actually going on around you. And at other times, you get one or two people coming at a time, and it was horrifying. And I was there, you know, hours. And you know, when you do something, you're really very often very concerned with the practical aspects of it. I was very concerned about the chemical toilet that I put in a shed in the, I bought a shed. I got a chemical toilet to go in the thing, because I was really worried that somebody would come. It was before health and safety, but I thought they would come from the future to say, you know, you, there's food in your bathroom. But actually, I'd have sealed it all off. Nobody checked. Nobody asked me a single question about why I'd done a single thing, actually. And never have really since. Or maybe a bit, but... what the pivotal thing about it was that it in its own terms, it was a huge success. I got people, friends, and a few people from the art world, but what I wanted it to be for was the local people. And they came in droves. Kids came every day after school. I made friends on the estate. They thought it was odd and dotty and mad, but they were lovely. And it was a really happy time. And I didn't really know, but I knew I was right to have done it. And then at the end, I was appalled by what I'd made, because I hadn't actually, I knew I wanted it to be eaten. And there were two things. One was that I wanted people to, who came at the beginning to see the beauty of it, I wanted them to see the end, which was a week later, and they didn't, of course. And I thought, well, actually, if I'm going to make work in future, I'm going to make work... it's my cat trying to get attention. I wanted to make work that was in a package so people could see the transformation, because I realised that always it was meant to be, you know, there were bits inside all the bodies that would be revealed. Like the father had this hollow chicken wire shell inside with these little birds I'd made, and I wanted people to see that. And I thought, well, that's a bit of a problem. And then the other thing was, I remember being so shocked I actually moved in with Andrew, because I had made my own family, and I didn't realise that. All that intuition was actually my very troubled early life coming out in this family. And I was the baby. That was the bit that was so awful. I was the only one who was completely vanished. Nothing apart from a greasy stain.
That's horrible.
And I remember Roland Miller and Shirley Cameron's twins coming, and they'd stab it with knives. And, you know, it was the 70s. Nobody minded stuffing cake in. And it was me. But I didn't realise that till afterwards. I didn't realise it to the end. And I was shattered, actually. And then I think that process of being shattered to see that I was working on my own, you know, at the time I had a very bleak view of family life. It's changed since. And my original, my family of origin, as they call it, has repaired a great deal. But I thought, well, that's what I do. So it was, in many ways, you know, if something goes well, you can learn from it. And if something goes badly, you probably learn more. I sort of certainly made my name to a degree. I then got, I can't remember it, one thing after another. It was, I did these icing sugar pictures. I got invited by Kettle's Yard for a food art exhibition. That was a very good experience. I learnt from doing that. There were a series of 18 pictures. That just finished my teeth off, actually. Because I used to suck the palate. I mean, they were copies of History of Modern Art, made out of sugar. but sort of through the stages, ending up with Carl Andre's bricks being covered with blue food colouring. It was a kind of commentary, a bleak commentary on the art world. And I didn't think those would last. I've still got some upstairs. They faded, but they were technically very sophisticated. And then I got invited to do something. I used to go to the ICA all the time, you know, I was hanging around there. And Ted Little, who was the quite wonderful director, asked me to do something. There's a performance art collective, Christmas dinner, and they make hot baubles. Christmas pudding in hot baubles. And Ted Little came up and he said, would I do a performance there? You know, at the moment you just think you're going to faint. And I did a thing called The Dinner Party, which is a performance, quite a formal performance. I wouldn't say it was great, but it was a proper piece. It was a proper one-off piece. Sort of had a good audience. And there were sort of problems. I didn't realise there were problems, but it kind of hung together. Mm. He asked me, because Andrew, I'd been with Andrew since I was 24, Andrew Whittock, my ex-husband, and he'd photographed a lot, especially the Edible family. There's a lot of interest in the Edible family. So Ted asked me, what about Sarah Kent, to do an exhibition in the foyer? So we had Andrew's photographs of the Edible family and some performances, my sugar pictures on that kind of corridor, and then I got commissioned to do a new piece of work in the other pit of the foyer, which was the art supermarket, and I applied to the Arts Council for money, and that was my folly, really. I decided that I would... that I wanted to make something commercial. I didn't like the commercial art world. That's what I liked about my food just being eaten, you know. That was like exquisite. I love supermarkets, but that was really desirable, and people would just want to buy it and own it, and they'd destroy it. And so I made 3,000 objects. It was meant to be a million. I remember when I was in my 20s, I had so many ideas. I'm very pragmatic at the same time as being rather carried away psychologically at times and with too much imagination. So I'd worked out all these ideas, and I worked out if I actually practically did all the ideas and raised the money, it would take me 15 years. And I thought by the end of 15 years, I will have had some other ideas and I won't be stuck doing the ones I had when I was 26, you know. So I remember that was quite a relief, thinking, actually, you can just think things and abandon them and preferably never tell anyone. It was when I was doing to do a million objects, and I worked it out, and I thought it's going to take me 5 years. Oh, God. So that was a nightmare, practically, and then I could never store someone, and they got locked in somebody's flipping studio down on Butler's Wharf. Oh, it was awful. I just had to churn them out, and a lot of sugar on them, And then we put it up, and I only had enough for one row of shelves and a little bit of a corner. And it wasn't a supermarket, it was just a bit of it. And people came, they all loved it, but, you know, they didn't buy enough. The idea was so stupid. It was like 10, if you could buy one thing for 10p, but if you bought 10 things, it would cost you £100. So nobody bought 10. I just thought, well, they'll want them so much. God. So, you know, by the end of it, it was awful. And then I realised also it wasn't about anything, it's about art. And then Caroline Tisdall came in, and she just breezed through, and she thought it was a man. She was writing about something else, and she wrote this horrifically, actually quite cruel review in The Guardian. And I decided never to make any work again, as one does. And then, so I was working for Andrew. I didn't make any work for about a year. And then Helen Chadwick got asked to do that show for the Hayward Annual. And she came and saw me. And she was she's a wonderful woman. Wonderful, wonderful woman. She was doing the live art bit. And with Genesis P. Orridge and Sylvia Saranik and four or five of us doing live work. And she just badgered me, actually. She badgered me. And I said, no, I can't, because I had this terrible experience and my work's crap anyway. And she was amazing. And that's when I think I did the best piece of that era in terms of live work, which was Packed Lunch. And it was at Hayward, and it was working with Andrew. He made 80 photographs of what it was like to do the to make the lunch, the packed lunch, male and female packed lunch, and then all the process. And then we made that into a slideshow. And then I had the packed lunches, and the packed lunch was the sort of slideshow with me serving the lunches to about 30 people at a time. And I also got invited, along with other people, to do the same performance in the National Exhibition Centre at Birmingham. There was a sort of free art stand from Birmingham Arts Lab. And actually, in the Hayward, you know what it's like in art galleries? People just... anything. Barely ate. And discovered years later that it had been a hit. You know, nobody said anything. And then I went to Birmingham, you know, like a few months later.
And devoured it.
But they were just so rivetingly interesting, the people. They'd just gone to see the Holmes exhibition, and they happened upon this. And I had these most exciting conversations with people. You know, why are you doing it? What is it? I don't agree. I like it. You know, it's just extraordinary. And so that made me realise that that's what I wanted. And then I just wanted kids. We wanted kids. And I did one more piece when Dora was a baby, called My Cooking Competes, which was a sort of version of that. And I realised I got quite a feminist following by then. Yeah, I'd got the feminist following when I did a performance called Perpetuity in Icing, when it was part of the art supermarket thing, which actually was a really good performance. And I thought, we all agree, but I didn't want to be doing performances for you. Mm. I want to be getting to the Birmingham arts, you know. Mm. And then I thought, well, this is too much effort. I would like to have babies. And I worked for Andrew then. I didn't make any more work for 8 years.
Those works at that time were very particular, and they were certainly known for your interaction with audience.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that people said, that, you know, there wasn't that boundary. The performer was not appearing to be in some celestial other world. They were in the same world as you. So you would cross and speak to people and allow people into the work. That was very unusual. That was an innovation at that time. I just wondered if you were aware of that you were making.
No, I'm a well brought up young woman from Sitcom. I mean, you don't blank people.
But it was kind of a very innovatory thing.
Really?
Well, it wasn't anybody else who was making performance who was doing that. They were all keeping people at bay, because although they were saying, well, I'm not making theatre, they certainly drew the line in the sand between them and the audience.
I didn't really know what theatre was, truthfully. Mm. I mean, I'd done it at school. I remember going to see Macbeth, and I wrote to Iago, who was a really classy actor, and he didn't reply, and I thought, well, sod that.
which classy actor?
I've no idea. I mean, I lost interest then, but I was sort of 17. But I actually, truthfully, would always look at theatre, and I still do to a degree, and I wanted to know what was going on backstage, and I wanted to know what they're talking about in the dressing rooms.
Yeah.
And I found that really troubling, because it felt disrespectful. And so it wasn't... I just couldn't do that. And then I always like to know what's really happening. So in my performances, I just had to be me. So I would tell people what was, you know, what had happened on the way there. I'd ask them if they were comfortable. I think it stems from the moment when I realised, you know, when I wept in the toilets, actually.
Yeah.
It really stemmed from that, because that was a life-changing moment in the extent, you know, when you try so hard to be something else.
Yeah.
To be someone else, you know. And there were these people who we'd all had a year off, and we'd come to do this art teacher certificate, and I'd seen extraordinary work. We all gave talks or had shows, and I was humbled, and here was my pathetic cakes, and I was popular, for doing them. And so I realised I could not be them.
Mm.
And from that moment on, anything I did was all right.
Mm.
Because I just thought, well, that is who I am. And I am seriously, you know, I'm brought up to offer people tea and coffee and cakes.
Mm.
And I was brought up to be somebody's wife and run a house. So it's natural. So anything I did or thought was automatically then part of it. And to be in with a... I mean, it was years later I started performing in theatres, which was a sort of conceptual or also an economic decision. This awful problem, you can't see their faces. So I always had the house lights on. I couldn't bear not to be able to see people's... You know, there's never been a script as such.
Mm.
There's always been a series of actions and then an interaction. So if people responded, I respond to them.
Mm.
Because it just felt the right way to do it. You know, if I'm having a conversation with you, I'm responding to your expression.
Yes.
And so if I'm having a... if I'm performing, I'm going to respond to their facial expressions. And apologise, because I was brought up apologetic as well. I've stopped that, thank God. But that was my persona, so I used it.
And you, and your realisation, as you said about things, you're using, making people see amusement in it and making them laugh with you, was a way of actually breaking that boundary.
Yeah, but also it just stopped it being so boring. Because this wonderful professor of psychology who I'm working with now, called Gail Hornstein, used an expression when she wrote about the diary drone book, and she said that I was a well-brought-up woman. And I thought, that just sums me up. And there was a tradition in my family of, you know, we'd laugh a lot, but my mum used to laugh a lot. And so making jokes, especially self-deprecatory jokes, is an innate part of my personality. And I think when I was troubled by the humour initially, but you know, if you're in a room full of 40 people sitting around the wall while you chop up a life-size cake and it's gone on for flipping hours, and you get kind of worried about them, and you think, I don't know what I'm doing, and I don't know why you're here, and this is all very embarrassing. And then I remember just I was doing a cookery demonstration. So this would have been 1975 when I graduated. And I had this tomato and I had a meat hammer, and I just said, oh, I'm going to squash this bloody hammer, tomato. I don't know why, I just thought, oh, this is so embarrassing, this silence. So I just went bop, and everybody fell about. And I thought, well, it's quite an ice. You know, the word now would be an icebreaker. It's such a relief.
Mm.
So I consciously used that and thought, well, I always, when I'm talking in public, seem to make people laugh. It is taking the piss out of myself, but it's also me. And so if that comes into performance, it's just me.
Just something occurred to me. Is it different in different countries?
Yeah, well, it's very popular, I realised, quite early on, because I didn't start performing abroad till I was in my 40s, really, because I went back to doing performance with drawing mother's experience, and I've always been embarrassed. I'm not now, but a lot of my life is embarrassed about being middle class. I'm kind of acutely aware of my privilege, and I also know, you know, intuitively, that people object to my, you know, who I am. I mean, people have interviewed me quite...
In England?
Oh, yeah. People have said, you know, I really hated you because you were middle class and I saw your performance. And then I got to know your work. And I mean, the mental health system, you're definitely discriminated on for any reason possible. And mine, the sort of person who's called middle class, you know, as a parent, it's just part of who we are. We all do it all the time. And because I object to that kind of privilege, or I did, and I think making fun of myself became a very cunning way. I knew quite clearly that by making fun of my English persona, and my, you know, who I look, my physique, my chin, my long face. I mean, Rose English did that.
Yeah.
She was a great inspiration. She did a performance. I remember her talking about it, where she ran round and round a room, and every so often she'd jump. And once she jumped so high, she hit the ceiling and knocked herself to the floor. She was wonderful about it. She said, you know, that you can use these moments.
Mm.
But I think I'd been doing it, but it was a sort of permission giving.
Mm.
But the Broad, yeah, people love to laugh at the British. And, you know, they resent us, but sort of an admiration at times. So, yeah, it can work in different places.
I'm just thinking, because the class system is everywhere has its own system, but you're describing a very English one, which the Broad can seem to be totally English. It's obsession.
Well, also, kind of culturally, it's pretty well known from a lot of our literature or films now. And it's kind of...
And from the comedy, of course.
Yeah, and that kind of comedy of the what we all use, of laughing about life. Mm. I mean, the best version of that I've found is groups of women in Glasgow doing performances there, who their wit is so sharp, you just want to die with delight. You know, that kind of mockery of life and themselves and people. So I don't think it's only, you know, me who would be funny. It's what we are. And like Germany, which is one of my favourite places to perform so far, is, you know, that I love the angst, because my life's been full of angst and the intellectual rigour of quite often. But also, they, you know, you do that and they go, ho, you English are so crazy. And that little package is, I like that. I think I've had more trouble with, I've performed in Sao Paulo, but I've had people from South America come to shows who get very, very excited by the weirdness. You know, they respond much more as I would. I'm quite a gushy person. But the sort of French Latin sort of places, that there's always a worry about language.
Mm.
I mean, actually, they have laughed when I've performed in France. So yeah, it's interesting.
Comedy itself. Are there heroes? I mean, apart from the art world, are there people in entertainment?
I don't like stand up. Actually,
no.
I just can't really get stand up. I get bored quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But I grew up, you know, we went 3 times to the theatre when I was a child. It was a big occasion on the train, you know, and we'd get a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
And once was Flanders and Swan. I remember it was such an occasion, you know, the excitement of it. And once we went to a circus, which I didn't like at all, and then we went to see Joyce Grenfell. And so Joyce Grenfell and Flanders and Swan were, is it Flanders? Yeah, I'm a Gnu.
Yeah.
We had that record, but they were, you know, I used to sing I'm a Gnu with my dad. And music hall things. He liked Arthur Askey. We liked telecomedy. I love the television. And then Monty Python. You know, I was a teenager and it was just amazing. I like French and Saunders. I like all sorts of... I tend to like sketch shows when they work. Situational comedy. No, I don't like... Series get really boring, formulaic, but I'm particularly keen at the moment on Roger and Val have just got in. It's not funny, actually, but it is. That's profound, that piece. Yeah, I mostly see what I like in terms of funniness stuff on telly and in films a bit. But I had the good fortune to talk to Marina Warner when she wrote about my work. And
it's a beautiful piece you wrote.
She's fantastic. Spot on, she is. It's really scary when you're talking to her and she sort of, you know, she's looked right in and she's spotted something you didn't know. So. But she said, and I read more afterwards about humour, about the rebellious nature of it, and that really chimed with me, that it's subversive. All my work's always been subversive. So it's been the nice middle class girl going, you know, and get you.
It also gets under people's critical radar.
Exactly. I remember I used to bargy-bargy with my father-in-law, who was he was a sweet man, but he was, you know, he was a sort of intellectual chauvinist, really. Mm. And he loved Drawing on a Month's Experience, for instance, and he said, and Kitchen Show, and he read Griselda Pollock's piece, and he said, she sees a feminist critique when I just see good, clean fun. So I, but, you know.
He's asked you for it, really.
But the thing was that I wanted him to see good, clean fun. He would never see the feminist critique, but I thought it would go in, and I've always wanted to reach a very wide audience and not have men walk out, have anyone walk out. Mm. I just wanted not to do that. That was the point. So, yeah, it became much, much, much more accessible.
And also the work became more complex in the staging of it.
Oh, yeah. So exhausting. I think the idea is it became a kind of a move, each show moved to another thing. Yeah. So you got the package of the 45-50 minute show, which is, it's an economic factor, you know, you can tour international festivals with that, with you and one or two other people, but then Kitchen Show, which was an incredible experience, opening my kitchen for public, that was a very political piece, and kind of difficult. Liv took it on with gusto in 1991, but it was the kind of economic factor, and part of the funding terms, it was from drama, so the only time I've had money from drama was that it would tour, and so we just lied through our teeth, you know, not knowing, Paul and I, how we would do that, and then I actually think we could open other people's kitchens to the public, and that really was exciting. That's when it got interesting. But the thing about that, when I decided at that point, rather unfortunately, to do a domestic quintet, which I thought was funny because it would take the piss out of the trilogies, you know, all those trilogies, the theatre and live art. Well, the more, you know, the high end, big productions we're doing. I thought having a quintet would be good. But also what I realised was that, you know, that there was such a range of spaces. So I wanted to do the supermarket. It was my life, you know, it was my passion. I wanted to do the health centre. I wanted to do the school, and I wanted to do the church. And actually, you cannot get 30 people to go run a supermarket with you. You can't get 30 people to go run a health centre. You can't. I did get 30 people to come into a primary school. Well, pragmatically, ticket price. Permissions in supermarket in those days, you couldn't even take pictures in a supermarket. I remember thinking of taking, you know, two people at a time, but it'd been struggle to sell Kitchen Show to Lyft, and that was X number of shows, you know. Mm. And it was beyond me to think of just taking. And anyway, the issue was, it was about a spiritual journey in the supermarket, which then had all these transformations in it. So how would I do that, technically? How would I fly up to the ceiling? You know? And so that was the great shift then. Each show became like, how do you do it? And that the great shift was to have it as a lecture about a shopping trip. And then it became very complex. And interesting in a way, but also complex technically, so I had to learn all that. And then the next one was, I think it was my favourite thing, and I, Paul and Everett did together. It was the most true collaboration, was Take a Peek, the festival hall. And that, you know, it was before anybody talked about promenade performances. I must have seen something like it. But this idea of, I think it was 20 people at a time coming through a installation, working with an architect, and doing these scenes and having two other performers. Mm. It was a really big shift, that, and very, very exciting to do.
And exhausting, I imagine.
I was pretty fit then.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember. I just remember it was the best fun I'd ever had. We had a lot of people working on it with us, volunteering and stuff. That was, it was a wonderful experience, actually. But the exhausting bit came after. I'd already, I think, started to find the pressure of the touring. We couldn't tour that. We did do the Arnolfini in Bristol, and that was just immensely complex. You could tour how to shop. No, the whole economy of it, and my age, so what would I have been, 45, you know, I was getting tireder, as you say, but then I was also touring 4 or 5 shows by then to keep it coming in.
Wow.
Didn't get proper Arts Council funding till about 5 years ago, you know, so it was like you got a very small core pot of money, but because you were live art, you couldn't get like a drama company would get, or a dance company. So we didn't have proper funding, we had to apply project to project. You had to keep the projects coming in and the project funding. And if it was a big production, it was like a drama or dance production where you get, you know, a decent whack of money, you'd have to piece it together. It was immensely difficult. And it took a great strain on my body and mind. Because, you know, I'm a mother, I was a wife, I had a family, kids growing up, And I feel great compassion for myself when I look back on it. I think it's partly my upbringing that I was brought up to be. Feel grateful for anything that happened. I didn't feel I really was entitled to be an artist.
So you didn't have compassion for yourself during it?
No, I kind of, it's a question of survival. It didn't occur, I didn't feel entitled to be an artist. I didn't feel entitled to claim the sort of support, financial or otherwise, and like ego trip people. But I was in a then in a kind of cross because I couldn't actually claim better funding because I wasn't brought up to. But I also didn't. Yeah, I was. When I look back on it, it was a period where I worked. I did 3 jobs from then on, and I toured internationally, project to project, and I had no. You know, and I, you know, I was in a group of people who did that, and we were lucky to get work. But the practicalities of it, trying so earnestly to be the perfect wife and mother, for instance, alongside working with Andrew on his work, which he took very seriously, was just too much for anyone.
Yeah.
And so then it started, the cracks appeared. And the cracks in my physical health appeared later. And so I took a gap between Take a Peek and Grown Up School. It was 4 years, because I put an application in for the 4th one, which was about evil in a primary school, which is problematic.
They liked that, the funders, did they?
They didn't realise what was going on. And I, that's when I really cracked up, and we did this horrific tour of... America, 5-week tour, and I just realised, you know,
yeah.
I went in the day centre after that.
How did you know? I mean, what were the signs that started to tell
you? I could not stop crying. Paul used to say that if you bottled my tears, you could sell them as holy relics. I produced so much, he said I'd be really profitable. No, I just felt... Actually, when I looked back on it, it was so obvious I couldn't hold it together.
Mm.
Could not hold it together. At the time, I felt it was my fault. I think when you're in a position, and this is common in mental illness, that you can't hold things together, you feel it's you. You start to internalise it. And I felt I was a failure. And I felt... a practical solution out of this financial problem. Andrew was similarly very pressurised because the economic crash had happened, which affected photography. He's a very successful commercial photographer. So we were both under a lot of pressure, trying to survive and bring our kids up properly. Yeah, I think... I just knew because I was distraught, actually. I kept on going to the doctor. I'm very good at putting a front on things. And I'd go to see my GP and cry And he said, well, why don't you come back again? And then, would you like to see this lady who does behavioural therapy? And I thought, well, that'll sort it out. three sessions, I saw a psychiatrist, and he said, I'd like to see you again. And I thought, you know, I just would cry. So this wonderful psychologist who took over, he said, we used to fear for the foundations of the building. Because I come in foot off the street, fine, and then weep.
Yeah.
Like nobody had seen anyone weeping before. Actually, it's just, I used to do that when I was at the day centre, and nobody knows how to react. But they, you know, they responded. And at the end of the three sessions with the psychologist, she said, I think you need more help. And I said, ooh, thank you, really? And then I saw him, and then he objected to me going to the day centre.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like it because it was alternative. And
yeah.
It was a, what's it called? Therapeutic community. A bit chaotic, a bit rebellious, I like that. I knew somebody had gone there. I thought that really suited me. I had an art room. Didn't want to go to the flipping day centre. I mean, at that stage, I just thought I'd go there 3 weeks and I'd be all right. But, you know, I think people know you just cannot hold it together and cope. And my most important role in life was holding it together at home for the kids. So I had to go outside the home to hide it from them. I didn't want to be like my mum, where her emotions were splattered all over everyone all the time.
When and how did you come to the incredibly brave kind of idea, exposure to bring it to the work, to bring it?
Oh, it was diary drawings.
Yeah.
Well, what had happened before was I managed to pull off Grown Up School. I was very ill, but I really love that show.
Mm.
It was a kind of complicated process, but I worked with Paul, but also with Mark Stora. Mm. We ran this project with the kids, and that was kind of turned out as a very gentle, quite dark, but gentle piece. And then I had to do Box Story. And Box Story is 2001, and that was just fabulous.
Mm.
But with Joss Pook. And it was a much simpler process. It was going back to drawing a mother's experience process. Much, much more straightforward, except with the choir. But with Joss, you know, and Harvey Brock. This Paul, Joss and I worked together. It was very comfortable. So, but in the meantime, I got asked by Lois Keaton and Tim Etchells and Adrian Heathfield, I think it was. They got some money to do something called Small Acts for the Millennium.
Yeah.
And you.
Oh, yeah, I did it as well.
This idea popped up to do Pull Yourself Together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a ball, you know. It was scary, actually, to do something. When we drove out off from my house, because it had been so technically so difficult to get the banners on the thing, and I thought, oh, no, here I am on a truck, exposed. They're in the van.
Mm-hmm.
But it was great, and it kind of hit a chord. And it was an amazing experience. I thought, well, that's okay. I could make work about being mentally ill. I think that was quite bleak, really, but I thought it was pretty obvious. I was very open about what was going on. And Box Story was a year later. I was less overtly about mental illness. And I was doing the drawings all the while, because I led this double life, you know. Mm-hmm. I did the drawings, didn't show them to anyone. I was completely caught up in the mental health system, in and out of bins, you know, psychiatric residential places, and patching myself up, and then coming out and carrying on and earning money. And oh, it's just terrible, terrible. I used to come out every day from this wonderful residential crisis house. I'd go home and cook and make the beds and everything, and then go. They weren't there. They didn't see me come and go, but I did that. I felt so terrible not being there. Worn out, physically started to sort of, was exhausted. And then I did, I was 51. I did Box Story, and then it was ages later when I got asked to show some drawings. By then I was showing them to professionals, and I'd come up with the idea to do How to Live Anyway, which was my answer to my critique of the whole therapeutic empire world. Was to make my own empire and it had to be launched at, on a big stage. I think the scale of the patheticness of a patient, it was just had to be on this, yeah. You know, that's what therapy empires do. But, oh God. And it was a culmination of a series of processes. It had to be different to the one before, it couldn't be Light Box Story. And I'd already worked with filmmakers. I'd worked with everyone I worked with on that show, apart from Structural and what are they called? A wonderful, the engineering company that Steve got involved. It'll come back to me, the incredible set builders that Steve involved. But so it was a real collaboration. That was just best, and got welcome money, and I worked with a psychologist. But people apparently didn't really even connect then that I was mentally ill. So went on from there, and then diary drawings were just going on. And so Andrew photographed some. It's an idea of a guy at Bath called Dan in Hinchcliffe to have an exhibition. And it was just, I think what happened there was that I didn't realise, like, my sister came to see them. And she knew I'd been ill and used to cry some. I just had tears running down her cheeks when she talked to me. And she said, oh, no, I could never see what was going on. And I thought, oh, I didn't realise people couldn't see. Mm-hmm. So, and I had the drawing. So that gave me more confidence. And then we showed them at Queen Mary, and then we showed them in psychiatric hospital. And then I thought, wow, you know, well, I've nearly finished them. There has to be the whole story. I was on a mission then. I was so angry. It was fueled out of fury at the stigma.
Stigma,
and I'd already started to experience real discrimination and judgment. I was more aware, because I was better by then, that people were judging me. Mm. And I was so objective, and I realised what was going on in the mental health system. And I just thought, people need to know. I had met the best people in the world in my journey who were judged. And I thought, I've got these drawings, I have a responsibility, really. And I did up talk to all Andrew and the kids and, you know, and approached the welcome, and they just said yes. And it was an amazing process. But it was a surprise how it was responded to, really. But I'm really glad.
It was needed.
I knew there were other people like me. I'd already connected and heard and read, and I knew a lot of words, and there were a lot of stories, and they'd made a huge difference to me and my family and friends. But there weren't any pictures. And I realised with How to Live in 2004, people could see it, but they could still have this wall. And they didn't really know. And I thought, well, I need to tell the story. I'm a human being. That was all I said. I was very political on stage, you know, a lot of committees. And, you know, we're human beings. We're human beings. We're people. We're you. We're you sick. And so they needed to see that. They needed to see the whole thing, because my drawing spanned everything. It was the stigma and the judgment. And I knew there were a lot of pictures out there. There was incredible artists, but they judged us. Sick art, or you know, or they don't value it themselves, it's just on some hospital wall, or things have moved a lot since. But it was a schizophrenic painting, you know. And I just thought, well, I've got the pictures, I went to art school, I learnt how to draw, I should try and do this. Live work is harder to grasp, and of course, there's a tradition of people doing odd things and funny things, if you think of, you know. And I think it's easier to just not realise.
So, were you conscious that you were using your history in some way?
Yeah, because I'd done it all along, and I really wish I didn't. But I, you know, part of deciding to make work about myself was making autobiographical work. That's part of it, you know. I make work at each stage of my life, which is about what's going on, and I have used stories about myself. And so this was about me, just part of a trajectory.
But it gave so much. So when you said, I'm not well, you came from a position of strength from everything you made before, which said, yeah. said something completely other than that.
Well, that's why at the beginning of that exhibition and the book, there's this the work that was going on while I was there. It's like, do not judge me. Like, you know, you ward manager. You know, I met some great people, but I also met some very judgmental people, embittered, you know, who've been, I think, traumatised by the system to cease to see us as people. She would sort of say, but why are you so successful and yet you're like this? And I said, because of that.
It's the same thing.
And you can't see me as a person now because I'm on the floor. And that was my power. That's when I realised it was all about power. All of it is about power. And I thought, power, money, everything. And I thought, right, I went to art school, I'm skilled. That was the thing that made me angry. So like, they're all going to take this more seriously because you can see the skill in drawing. They don't recognise the skill in performance because it's different. They can see the skill of an actor or a film, but it's harder with live work. And it really annoyed me because I knew, you know, when live work worked, it was because there was a skill. And so I was really preparing myself to be not to be irritated. But as it was, it communicated. It didn't matter, it wasn't about the skill. That was handy. I'd gone to art school and done thousands of hours of drawing. My mother otherwise would send me to secretarial college, you know, but I wouldn't have gone. But you know, that actually, well, who cares? It was images, and it worked. Who cares?
Yes, it did. It worked for lots of other people. And well, that was a new audience.
That was astonishing. See, Dora and I, Dora, which is my psychologist daughter, and I, we all had different views of it, but we never thought that it would touch children. You know, young people who related to Dora and Charlie. Professionals, people like me, but you know, friends, people who had no experience. We didn't realise that. How would you realise that? So what a privilege. And I suppose the telling the story, the autobiographical bit, was a huge piece of work, actually.
Are you aware of the level of gratitude out there towards you?
I've encountered it a bit. I mean, I found it a bit embarrassing, you know, and a bit humbling. I think the only way to respond is to respond humbly, because that's why I kind of focused on the aspirational parents bit. Sure. You know, I grew up in a culture where my dad got up at 6:30 and cleaned the grates before he went to work, you know, and bought us bread and butter because he was fearful of night starvation, having grown up on a farm. Weird, you know. And my mum worked hard. I was taught to work and expected to work. And then in an education system where, you know, that, and then I think learning what I learned, it did feel that I had a responsibility, and that the odd thing about people saying, well, you know, you're an artist, it doesn't just happen. You know, you've got a predisposition, and then a lot of terrible things happened to me when I was young, and they lead you more to that. And it also becomes a habit, thinking of new ideas. You know, it's just a habit, because it's easier to think of a new idea than think that you're going to go into a psychiatric hospital. So whenever anything like that happened, I used to think, oh, I'll sort that piece for that show out. It's just the way your brain works. It's easier to think of an image than, you know, it's powerful too. And then, you know, you get to a point where you've, like a lot of people I know like me, you know, who work in all sorts of ways. We've all gone through all that work, and then you get to a point where it comes together or it doesn't. So that feels like a responsibility and a privilege, you know. But it's also bloody hard work, and I wish it wasn't so badly paid along the way. Or recognised. Or to be told, to be encouraged to feel that it was valuable work, and you could ask for money, you know, rather than being just some spare group of people who get invited to a conference, because actually everybody's going around talking about art and art pieces and discussing their work and producing it and everything, and then they forget there's no artists in the room. Mm. You know, that it's a collaboration.
Mm, indeed.
And I've always believed in that. You know, everybody should be valued at every level in that thing. So, yeah, so when you say, you know, how do I relate to people's kind of gratitude, I would like to say, well, it just happened to me and it's a responsibility and thank you, but it's not really about me.
Tell us about the future.
I'm a grandmother.
That's another few jobs to take care of there. Oh, in between, yeah. Everything else.
I like being alive. I have a lovely flat. I've got great family and friends. I've got a very nice cat, although she's attention-seeking. I've got a little granddaughter of 6 weeks called Audrey. And I like everyday life, really. I like the television. I see the future as being an enormous amount of watching the television. Quite a lot of going to the cinema. Quite a lot of social life. I want to get a dog.
Cat won't like it.
She doesn't know yet. She deserves to be put in her place. Come from Battersea like her. And I want to go on being an artist, and I'm a kind of career artist. I see myself as a civil servant at the moment, because I get money from the government to make work, and so it's a very serious responsibility the next 3 years, in a much best organised way I've Good. Encountered. Do a series of projects, which actually are, although my new show, Mad Gyms and Kitchen, is me performing, it's a tool to get people to think about themselves much more concretely, to make work. And the show after that, Geography Dog and History Cat, I really just want to be, I'm going to be...
So Geography Dog
and History Cat. I will appear as the owner of Roxy, and maybe the dog, who will be the field trip investigators to research the lives of other people who will make the films.
Wow.
A virtual map. But that's the end of the sort of big, I don't think I'll make any more performances. I mean, small, informal ones, want to do a flash mob. But not the touring, economic touring thing. And I really want to do more painting and drawing, and illustrating, and animated films. And if I could fit that all in, well, it's a financial thing, isn't it? But also the drawing and the painting is the passion. And see if I can make that pay in some way. So I have time to watch Midsummer Murders of an afternoon.
And there isn't anybody who's going to tap you on the shoulder?
No. No, because I, you know, history changed that, art history changed that when the stories came out, which was probably during the, towards the end of the 70s and 80s, all the stories were written about. And then I realised that the reason I was so passionate about Jane Austen and Virginia Woolf is because it's economically easier to write than it is to paint. And there were the most remarkable artists of all shapes, sizes and genders, you know, and that, you know, it, yeah, I think that changed it. And of course, younger women, it's great relief there are younger people doing things. So I just, yeah, I feel not bothered about that. I just wish I stopped acting out, experiencing through my idiocy every single health problem that women encounter, and I sort of just think, oh no, I wish I'd known, you know, that you get depressed, I wish I'd known that you get breast cancer, or, you know, I just wish there was something.
There aren't many more on that list, are
there? I don't know, I just think
there aren't any more on that list.
I just seem to have encountered all that, you know, well, like my teeth will fall out, or there'll be something, you know. So I'd like to have a life which doesn't induce ill health, really. That's what I'd like most of all. I'd like to have a everyday happy life.
I'm sure you will.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. I've just got to put a footnote in, because I was talking to Brian, I realised I said the wrong Bruce. for the story with Gilbert and George, it was Bruce McLean, who's another hero. He was the performer of the poses, and Bruce Lacey was in his factory in Hackney doing something else. He wasn't with Gilbert and George. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. Just in the moment, I'm 61.